Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Before the development of the economic and agricultural concepts that we have taken for granted in the past 75 years or so, the Earth's ecological systems developed in self-supporting and self-sustaining ways that have yielded to corporate systems of growing food and the delivery of food. The term permaculture comes from an effort to secure and resecure these self-supporting and self-sustaining systems by obtaining the optimum benefit of food production in the most local of all arenas, our individual homes and gardens. In this edition of Radio Curious, we visit with James Stark, who lives and works in Bolinas, California, where he is the co-director of the Regenerative Design Institute, where he teaches programs in community development and leadership, and is a partner in Sustainable Living Designs. Further information may be found at www.regenerativedesign.org. James Stark will be talking at the Mendocino College Little Theater in Ukiah on Saturday, May 31st at 7 p.m. In this conversation with James Stark about permaculture, recorded on May 25th, 2008, from his home in Bolinas, California, we discuss how to make an edible jungle in your front yard and your backyard. James Stark, welcome to Radio Curious.
Thank you for inviting me.
Permaculture. It's something that was ruptured during the agricultural and industrial revolution, maybe beginning 500 years ago. But can you share with us what it is?
Well, permaculture, and the term permaculture was coined by Bill Mollison and David Holmgren. And they worked on looking at what made forest ecologies really stable, resilient, and abundant. And out of that, they came up with some working principles of what were the laws of nature that were in place that had those forests so strong and resilient.
What are those laws of?
Well, there's a whole range, from symbiotic relationships and stacking functions, and just when you look at the forest and seeing how everything is intimately connected and how there are plant guilds, that different plants support each other. Out of these working principles of nature also came out ethics for permaculture, which was based on three things: the care of people, the care of the earth, and recycling and appropriate use of resources. So out of ecological principles and ethics, permaculture was coined, and it was originally to indicate permanent culture. Later on, the word came out sustainability, and I think it's the succession about permanent and then sustainability and then regenerative culture.
How can someone become involved in permaculture?
Well, to become involved in permaculture, one of the traditional ways has been to take a permaculture design course, which is a two-week course, where you're taught the basic principles of permaculture design and do some design work and take on project work.
Tell us about what those basic principles are.
Well, the basic principles that that one would use would be, as I mentioned, stacking functions, so that when you go about building a structure, you don't only build it for one purpose. You try to figure out how many different functions can you get out of that one building. So if you wanted to build a building for some sheep or something, or if you wanted to build a little writing shed, so you could go out and do writing. So you have that function, but then if you collected water off the roof, then you're looking after your drinking water in addition. The building could, if you're in a hot area, provide a shaded area behind if you locate it well, so that you could grow lettuces in the shady area behind. If you situated it in such a way that you had a cob wall, earthen wall in the front, that would collect heat, then maybe if your area was such that you wanted to grow things that required a hot climate, then you could put your citruses in front of the building so that you could add food. So then you've got a building, you're doing something inside, and you're collecting water, and you're growing food, creating a cool zone and a hot zone. And then maybe you put a solar panel and integrate that into the system, so you're starting to generate electricity. Whatever you're doing is you try to work in as many functions into the design as you possibly can.
Essentially, foreseeing the consequences of what you're doing and taking advantage of them.
Right, exactly. And what you're doing is you're using one of the main principles in permaculture is observation. And you're always asking questions. So you're observing what is going on and learning more about the natural system where you're living. And out of that observation, then you build to glean what is going on in that land. Your property is teeming with life, and we're kind of like the last of the party. You know, there's so much going on in the soil. There's so much going on above the soil. There's all the bird and animal life. There's the patterns of the wind. There's the water patterns on your land. All of this is really juicy information that you want to take in. Permaculture designer would begin with a property, and ideally a couple years of observation on a new piece of property where they're going to develop a homestead or whatever. And because you're going to want to know what the wind patterns are in all the months, you're going to want to know where the water flows on the land. You're going to want to know where the land dries up first by reading the plants on the land. If you see equisetum, then you know that there's moisture there. So it's understanding basically what the plants are, and then they tell you information about the water system on your land.
You mentioned equisetum. Mm-hmm. What is that?
Equisetum is just one of the plants that really loves water. On our site here, we have them all over. They're just a tall, a spiky plant that comes up with a whole fan of branches that comes out from around it, and it can be, you know, maybe anywhere from a foot and a half, depending on the water, to really tall ones. We've got some that are 4 feet tall. They just grow spontaneously in our gardens here, and we leave them unless we need that space so that they can play their role in the ecology. We're experimenting right now with cutting them off, because if you cut them off or you're doing any excavating, you'll notice that throughout the summer they'll continue to pump water even though they've been cut off. It's studying that and looking at that plant and saying, oh my God, you know, that it just keeps bringing water up to the surface. Maybe they can be like little drippers. And so, you know, experimenting with that. So we're always looking at the plant world and seeing what all the symbiotic relationships are. One of the things we do in permaculture is put together plant guilds, which are, you know, what happens in the forest, but in how we'd apply it in a food forest at your home is with a fruit tree, and you may put comfrey all around the roots of the fruit tree. And the comfrey brings up minerals from the, has a deeper taproot, brings up minerals to the surface, and the fruit tree is a surface feeder. So now you've got comfrey, which not only is bringing up nutrient and creating duff around the fruit tree, keeps the moisture in as well, and also keeps other plants from growing underneath the fruit tree that are top feeders. And that's why, in, you know, when you go into these large industrial orchards, they don't have any plants growing underneath the trees. They spray them, and because they don't want the competition. However, you can have plants underneath there. It's just you have to choose the right plants. And then So the comfrey can be on the front side, on the south side underneath the fruit tree, and then you could put some rhubarb around there in the shadier where it gets dappled light. And so what you've done is you've set up this whole symbiotic relationship of three plants that really get along well together and then produce a little ecology. And so what you're trying to do is really figure out all these different plant guilds that you can put together in your garden so that everything has a relationship to each other as much as you possibly can. And that's what you're trying to do. Because in permaculture, what you're really trying to create is a food forest around your house.
An edible jungle.
An edible jungle at all levels, so that underneath the ground you've got root crops going on, then you've got plants just above the ground, and then you've got climbers and maybe some semi-dwarf or dwarf fruit trees, and then you just keep going up until you get your main canopy trees, which could be fruit tree, full standard fruit tree. So you got food going at all levels. So you're not just looking at, well, I've got X number of square feet of backyard or front yard. You're measuring it in cubic feet. And so, you know, how can I get food into all those aspects?
Where would a person begin? Let's say they have either a few acres out in the woods or in rangeland, or they have a house in town with grass in front.
You really start with observation. And so you document and map the wind patterns and water patterns and look at the plants and the animal patterns, track the sun patterns, where is there a lot of sunlight in the morning, and where's the sunlight in the afternoon and then late in the day. You want to look at your soil quality. You know, you're going to dig some samples at various places. You're going to want to start thinking about the water flow on your land. Where does it go? How you might be able to collect water. If you've got more than a very tiny backyard. Even if you have a tiny backyard, you're probably going to want to have a little pond in there. But if you got an acre or more land, where would the pond go? Where would the pond go in relationship to the driveway, to where the house, where would the barn go? All of those major elements of designing this basic structure.
Let's talk about ponds for a minute.
Sure.
Particularly in an era with mosquito-borne diseases, how do you deal with the mosquitoes?
Well, the mosquitoes that carry the diseases that we're trying to avoid really breed in the old tires and the pail that's sitting, has some water in the bottom of it around the yard. That's where you get the mosquitoes who are carrying diseases. Mosquitoes that are in our big ponds are not carrying those diseases. But then what you do on the ponds, just to reduce the number of mosquitoes, you make a balance with your fish, and you can get native minnows that eat the larvae, and whatever the fish you put, other fish that you put in there, all work on reducing that. And the main thing on your property is to make sure there's no standing water anywhere if you're concerned about getting bitten by a mosquito and contracting something.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with James Stark, the co-director of the Regenerative Design Institute in Bolinas, California, and a partner in Sustainable Living Designs. He also teaches at the Regenerative Design Institute, programs specializing in community development and leadership. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. James, what drew you to employing permaculture and making it such a significant part of your life?
Well, I think it probably started with growing up on a sheep and cattle farm in Canada. And my ancestors had lived on this particular piece of property since 1839. So when I arrived, you know, our family had been on that land for 150 years. Visiting my grandparents, you know, and I'm in my early 60s, basically, you know, they were on a permaculture site, and many of the aspects were there. One, they were all powered. The water was being pumped by windmills. They had cisterns. They had fruit cellars. They were growing all their own food. They were using horses for transportation and working. There was no electricity. They had compost toilets. You know, so they were basically off the grid living. So for me, a lot of the elements of regenerative design that we see coming up that we teach about and will be essential in as we move into the post-petroleum age, a lot of that is a couple generations back we were doing things like that. Now, it doesn't mean that everything that we were doing on the farm was sustainable or regenerative. There were some practices that didn't make any sense. You know, one of the things on the farm, you always thought you were really lucky if a stream went through the barnyard, because then you didn't have to worry about carting water for the cattle. They could just drink out of the stream. Well, that wasn't a good practice, and so you drop out the practices that ecologically we know that didn't make sense, but then you adopt the rest of them. We grew all our food in without chemicals. Being organic wasn't a big stretch. My own parents, when we were farming, we had the same fruit cellar and grew our own food and did our preserves and all that kind of stuff. That was just how I grew up, in compost toilets when I was really young, and then eventually we got indoor toilets. You know, it's a way of life that was really lively for me. And so when I heard the message coming from Rachel Carson about what I was seeing in the spring that was going on around us, and the whole industrial ag that was unfolding, it wasn't a big stretch to say, well, I get it, and I totally agree with Rachel, this is not going to work. And we've all, you know, had thousands of years of providing for our needs without all of that. So that's kind of the basic roots, and of course it's another story how I ended up south of the border. But
well, I want to hear that story in a moment, but when you mention things that don't make practical sense, mm-hmm. can you give our listeners some tips on what to look for in our everyday, quote, modern life now?
Well, there's a lot of things that are just for self-serving purposes, but you know, some of the fundamentals that you know, painting your home with paint as opposed to using a clay plasters, you know, so if we put on a quarter inch of earth plaster and color our homes with that, then when you finish that job, you then have that house colored for probably two or three generations, because the color is a quarter inch thick and it's non-toxic, whereas, you know, the one of the approaches we now are into is the paint. And even if you get low VOC paints, they're like $80 to $100 a gallon, and they're still just this very just a very thin coating, so they chip, and then you got to paint again. So it's all this expense, and they're still off-gassing. So I think one of the things in permaculture, we really look at how can we not have our homes being gas chambers, because that's fundamentally what they are. When you look at the 85,000 or 90,000, whatever it is right now, different people have different estimates on that, different chemicals that are part of our culture, and we bring these things into our home and they off-gas. And so really our homes are gas chambers. And then one of the worst ones is our brand new cars. And, you know, I always everybody loves that smell of a new car, and especially you really get that smell when it heats up and it's, you know, you're in Ukiah and it's midsummer and it's about 110 in that car. Well, that new car smell that they replicated with the little Christmas tree thing when your car isn't smelling like that. But the smell is the toxic chemicals that are coming off the plastics and all the material that are in there. And then they all end up in our liver. So it's really just looking at all the ways that we can begin to clean our interior environment and not pollute the exterior. You know, looking at ways that you don't have to be running a lawnmower, which produces in 1 hour the amount of pollution that your car, which is more efficient, does in 7 hours.
Are you suggesting then that people don't have lawns, or they trim the lawn in some other fashion?
Well, you can have lawns, and a lot of people love lawns for a particular reason. One of the questions is, how big does that lawn have to be? What are you going to be doing on it? And would you far sooner have strawberries out there? And if you have a little lawn, we've done permaculture designs for people, and some people want to have a little lawn so they can, kids can roll around on it and play ball or croquet or something. But you have it a minimum size so that you can cut it with a manual cutter or just reduce that toxicity just by going manual on it. Or you can plant grasses that don't want to end up, you know, a couple feet tall, and so they're just low, and you do that, or put some other kind of ground covers on, chamomile or something, and then you can go out and pick the flowers for your tea.
Let's go back to clay plaster.
Mm-hmm.
How can a person get the materials and learn the application? Most people understand the can of paint and brush or roller
right.
concept.
The materials can be gotten, you know, one of the elements is sand, and then you're going to want some clays, which you can usually get from a ceramic supply place, and iron oxides for coloring, you know, to get the different colors. And there are some really good books on plastering that's come out. Yonto Evans is one of the people with Cobb Cottage Company up in Oregon who came over and has been teaching a lot of that, and now there are people throughout America who are teaching that kind of technique. So people could, you know, just Google it. And
James Stark, you mentioned that you were born and grew up in Canada. What brought you to California?
Well, actually, when I came to California, I moved to California from Southeast Asia. I had been working for about 5 years out of Thailand and Indonesia, addressing issues and environmental and social issues created by tourism development in Southeast Asia, and was working there. Then on some of my trips to conferences and things in California, on one of my trips, I met Penny Livingston, my wife. We got married, and I ended up moving from Asia to California. When we got together, Penny had about a 20-year-old landscape design build firm, and I had an interest in international and local development. So we started working together and formed the Permaculture Institute of Northern California. And we've been working and living together for the last 17 years and doing the work that we do here at the Regenerative Design Institute.
Well, James Stark, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask a couple of questions.
Sure.
One of them, can you share with us an interesting concept or idea that you've learned in the past year or so?
Well, one of the things I've been looking at is just on a personal level, the whole area of attachments. And how attachments, our personal attachments to beliefs and the way that we think the world is structured, affects and constrains my ability to be open for infinite possibilities in working in the world and being of service in the world. And it's really been the move from Rumi talked about, and we just passed his 800th birthday in September, and one of the things that he said was, out beyond right and wrong, there is a field. I'll meet you there. And one of the areas that I've been learning about is the attachments I've had of judging things as good and bad and right and wrong as an activist and doing work in the world. That has been a breakthrough for me to transcend that and finding out that it isn't really essential to being to doing service in the world. It isn't essential to categorize things in that way. And so I've been practicing with Rumi's guidance of how to be out in that field beyond that.
And James Stark, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Well, a book that I just finished, which I really appreciate a lot, is called The Biology of Belief, and it's by Bruce Lipton. And this book, Lipton is a doctor and medical researcher in the whole area around cell research, and his breakthrough has been to demonstrate and prove that the functioning of the cell is not dependent on the DNA and what's going on inside the cell. It's really about the influences outside the cells that are dictating what's happening with the cell, and therefore has been able to prove that our thoughts impact how our cells function. So, in other words, this has amazing implications, and it's basically backing up what a lot of people in the healing arts already know, but he's putting the proof behind it, is that that one can heal oneself, or what's the mechanics of other people healing people through prayer or intentions, or bringing it to particular parts of the body to alter how the cells are functioning for people who are challenged by diseases. And also the part that, depending on what your thought patterns are, the possibility you're going to be reducing some the diseases that you could end up having if you are, if your mind is generating from a positive place.
Well, James Stark, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Well, it's been my pleasure to be on your program.
James Stark is the co-director of the Regenerative Design Institute, where he teaches programs in community development and leadership. He is also a partner in Sustainable Living Designs. Further information may be found at www.regenerativedesign.org. James Stark will be talking at the Mendocino College Little Theater in Ukiah on Saturday, May 31st at 7 p.m. The book he recommends is The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter, and Miracles, by Bruce Lipton. This interview with James Stark was recorded on May 25th, 2008. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. And the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.